Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight at our sort of spaced out, in a physical sense, meetings that we're holding in the time of pandemic. And special greetings to our members and supporters on Zoom, particularly those in lockdown Melbourne, for whom we all feel deeply at the moment and hope it all works out soon. So tonight, Senator Andrew Bragg makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. I'll introduce him very briefly. Educated at the Australian National University in Canberra, background in accountancy and financial services, but most importantly, Senator for New South Wales since the 2019 election. And tonight, we're our speaker's going to speak about Baraja, the Liberal case for national reconciliation, and we've got copies of that book tonight, which our speaker will sign, and we'll sell some in the room and some online to those who are not in the room. So, Andrew Bragg, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Jared. And good evening, everyone. I will start by acknowledging the traditional owners. And I wanted to thank you, Jared and Anne, for having me very much. There are too few policy clearinghouses in Australia, and that makes the Sydney Institute all the more important because it is somewhere where we can come and have a discussion about issues of great national importance. So tonight I want to talk about the new book, Baraja, which means tomorrow in the Darug language of the Yuin people of the south coast of New South Wales. And I guess the question is, why would a Liberal senator write a book about Indigenous affairs? And the answer to that question is the serious and intractable issues that face Indigenous people are dogging the nation. And there is going to be a lack of the legitimacy until we solve these questions. I believe the gap that we talk about a lot, which is better known as closing the gap, is a consequence of the great Australian silence, which was first coined by the anthropologist Bill Stanner in his Boy Lectures in 1968. As I said in my first speech to the Senate back in 2019, which feels like a lifetime ago, it is the nation's unfinished business. We all know that to be true. I think Australia is a great country, but it has not always been a great country for Indigenous people. And so what I want to do tonight is to set out the key Liberal and Conservative arguments for reconciliation and for the Uluru Statement from the heart. Before I do that, I want to acknowledge that writing books as a sitting member of Parliament sometimes tests one's colleagues, and I want to thank my colleagues for the support they've given me to set out my ideas. The Liberal Party still is a big tent, and this book has been supported with a generous and kind forward from the Prime Minister. I think the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, is developing a strong record on Indigenous affairs, which builds on the very strong record of Harold Holt and Malcolm Fraser. Innovation and leadership in Indigenous affairs has been a golden thread of Australian liberalism. It doesn't mean that everything we have done is good. There's been good and there's been bad. But that thread has always been there. Billy Wentworth was arguing for a voice to Parliament, in effect, back in the 1960s. His contemporaries that I interviewed for this project, like former Liberal Party director Tony Eagleton, told me how much Billy Wentworth influenced Harold Holt. Harold Holt, as you know, delivered the referendum in 1967 to arm the national government with the power to legislate for Indigenous people and to be included in the census. But too few of us, I should say, remember him for this achievement. We remember him instead for his death. I don't believe his successor or predecessor would have taken the formula that he took to the people in 1967. And had he not disappeared from that beach, he would have been able to write a biography, he would have been able to nominate his key achievements, and we would remember Holt as a person that delivered the most successful referendum in Australian history. In the book written by Professor Tom Frame, there are just four pages devoted to the referendum. Now, this is not a reflection on Frame. I think Frame is a brilliant person and has supported me personally. But four pages dealing with this most important referendum in the single biography on Holt, I think, is a good reflection of Tony Abbott's edict that Liberals should write more books, because the failure to better understand the past shrinks our capacity to be ambitious in the present. Malcolm Fraser delivered land rights laws. These laws today have led to the bulk of the Northern Territory being under the control of the original owners. The Fraser era was not a period of economic reform, but it was impeccable on Liberal values. A fair deal for Indigenous people and a strong humanitarian approach on Vietnam and South Africa. The thread really bloomed during this period, and I was able to interview all three of Fraser's ministers for Aboriginal Affairs, Ian Viner, Peter Boehm, and Fred Chaney. They all say Fraser was instrumental in shepherding through controversial, highly controversial land rights laws in the face of enormous opposition from the Northern Territory government, pastoral and mining sectors. Yet the nation remembers Gough Whitlam pouring the dirt through Vincent Lingiari's hands. We don't give Fraser enough credit for driving this first land rights system. The renowned Indigenous leader Charles Perkins described Fraser as the best leader on Indigenous affairs. He said Fraser was A1. Our Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, has presided over the radical overhaul of the Closing the Gap targets in collaboration with the Coalition of the Peaks. I'm sure this will be a historically significant contribution. The PM has assured that this critical reform agenda, which is designed to boost education, health and economic participation, is now co-designed with appropriate input from the community itself. This is the commitment he made to fund the voice co-design process, which is currently underway through Ken White's department. He has also changed the anthem. Australia's greatest sporting champion, Cathy Freeman, said on New Year's Day, "What a way to start the year, a phone call from our Prime Minister to say that we are one and free. Thank you." So far, the process of putting the book together has made Tony Abbott's point that Liberals should write more books because we have good things to say. And so I would say to you tonight that there are four reasons that we should lead this next historic reform agenda. We have a historical record, which is significant and has proven that it can deliver big reforms in the past. The illiberal laws that we have in this country for Indigenous people require a special system. Thirdly, this is a patriotic agenda. And finally, we should also build on our contribution in Canberra, the nation's purpose-built capital. Reconciliation, in my mind, comprises hard and soft components. The hard parts are the constitutional components and the Uluru Statement. The softer components go to how we see ourselves as a nation, especially in that purpose-built capital. So firstly, on the historical record, we have delivered key reforms. The Menzies government established AATSIS, which is the body charged with conserving and preserving Indigenous language and culture. This is the institution which helped the Yuin people preserve the Darugan language, which has given us the name for this book today. Menzies also passes voting rights reform through his minister, Paul Hasluck, in 1962. This is the reform that allowed all Indigenous people to vote in Australian federal elections. Many people have had this confused with the referendum. The referendum was about the census, and it was about establishing a power for the Commonwealth to legislate in this area. Menzies stopped short of doing what the Aboriginal lobby in the 60s wanted. He was prepared to include Aboriginal people in the census, which would have required a constitutional amendment. He was not prepared to argue for a Commonwealth power to legislate in this area. These amendment bills were passed by the Menzies government, and when Holt came to office, he decided that he would junk that plan and start again. Holt decided that he would, in effect, go all the way and would propose a constitutional amendment of two forms. One, the census change, and two, the constitutional head of power. Holt's referendum won with a 90% majority. Amongst other things, the referendum brought one Neville Bonner into the orbit of the Liberal Party. Bonner would join the one mile branch of the Queensland division of the Liberal Party. After being castigated on polling day, this is referendum day, by the local member Bill Hayden for not helping Labor. This year, on 15 August 2021, we mark the 50th anniversary of Bonner's appointment to the Australian Senate. He's a great historical figure and a Liberal that we can be proud of. Holt's ambition for Indigenous affairs, of course, was cut short by his untimely death. The cudgels were then picked up a decade later by Malcolm Fraser. Fraser delivered the Land Rights Act, which led to the traditional lands being returned to traditional owners. The process also spurred the states into action. The Tonkin government in South Australia was the first, and other state governments followed. Fraser's laws, for example, led to the return of Uluru to the traditional owners during the Hawke government. Fraser, of course, could have walked away from this controversial agenda after the dismissal, but he decided to see it through. But I should say, for the record, there is no question of the commitment of Whitlam on land rights. I mean, certainly he commissioned the Woodward Royal Commission, and he would have passed his own version of land rights laws had he remained in office. The next really significant reform was native title, which was effectively delivered by the High Court, but then codified in statute by the Keating government. The Native Title Act was amended by the Howard government, but largely left intact. So as I catalogue in the book, the Liberal Party can claim two of the three structural changes, the power to legislate and the creation of the land rights regime. Labor has made important contributions, but the mythology of Labor and Indigenous policy is overblown. Hawke cried about his failed treaty. Rudd at least delivered the apology and the initial framework for closing the gap. This is not about politics, it's not about point scoring, but it's about making sure that the Liberal side is aware of the significant contribution so that we can continue to build on that in the future. Forgetting your past means that your ambition is lowered, and I've seen this happen. The next historic contribution could well be the commitment on constitutional recognition and the obligation to consult Indigenous people. It is there for the taking. The second point is a Liberal laws demand a special system. We have 18 different laws on our books in Canberra which are made especially for Indigenous people. Native title, land rights, Aboriginal corporations, heritage protection, just to name a few. Indigenous people are the only Australians with a slew of laws made for them. I believe this means we must have a special system in which to deal with these laws. We should be prepared to receive community input into these special laws, whether they're made under the race's power, the territory's power, or for any other purpose. Direct input would significantly improve the understanding mere legislators have over special laws we make for Indigenous people. I know that when we passed amendments to the Native Title Act last year in the Senate, I thought to myself, wouldn't it be good if we knew what the people on the ground thought about these amendments? A voice would serve both practical and symbolic purposes. The practical provides agency. The symbolic delivers the recognition long promised by my party, to which I shall return in a moment. Denying people a say over these special laws is illiberal and wrong. I don't understand why anyone would want to stop this sort of non-binding advice being tendered to legislators. There are worse things we can do than conduct more community engagement. But as you know, there are mixed views on this in my party. Some Liberals and Conservatives have called this a third chamber. Others have said race has no place. I, along with Julian Lisa MP, the member for Barara, are two of the most enthusiastic supporters of a special system, and there is a growing group inside the coalition party room in favour of our voice. I wrote the book Barraja to build out the Liberal case, which I was most keen to see the colleagues adopt. I felt that without a book like Barraja, we would be left with just two arguments, race has no place and the third chamber. both of which are totally fraudulent. I don't believe we can seriously entertain the idea that the Australian people will support a complex constitutional amendment. As I establish in the book, there are worthy drafting amendments from Anne Toomey, Noel Pearson, Megan Davis and co, which are legally sound, but I believe will be too detailed from a campaigner's perspective. Anne Toomey, Professor Anne Toomey, I should say, has created two drafts of the constitutional amendments. One in 2015 that would establish a new body in the Constitution, and one in 2020 that would impose a constitutional obligation on the Commonwealth to ensure that Indigenous voices are heard. The second drafting amendment in 2020 places a simple and clean obligation on the Commonwealth to consult Indigenous people on laws which are made for them. This is a good idea, a fair idea, and something that we can sell. It would be consistent with the principles set out in my first speech, which were that an amendment must do five things: capture broad support of the Indigenous community, focus on community-level improvements, maintain the supremacy of Parliament, maintain the value of equality, strengthen national unity. In my first speech, I also quoted Murray Gleeson's paper, which made the case for why the proposal is safe from a legal and constitutional perspective. I'm not a lawyer, and I don't claim to make the case about what will or will not work from a lawyer's perspective. Rather, I've listened to the former Chief Justice, and I've been thinking about what would work not only from the lawyer's perspective, but also from the campaigner's perspective. And I say this as someone who's had some experience of selling controversial changes to the Australian people. In 2017, I was engaged as a leader of the Liberals and Nationals for Yes campaign on same-sex marriage. That campaign won 71 of 76 coalition seats. In an effort which focused on fairness and families, the simplicity of the position that you're going to give something to a minority without taking anything from any other Australian is a proven method. Putting an obligation on the Commonwealth to consult doesn't give a special deal to a minority. It provides a duty to consult which should have been there at the outset. After all, I'm interested in the outcome, which would see a voice set up in legislation because the Constitution required it, exactly what Uluru calls for. When he launched my book in Canberra, Ken Wyatt acknowledged the attitude of the Australian people is changing. The people are becoming more supportive. I noticed it in my own generation of new parliamentarians. It is very encouraging, but we need to think about what the people will ultimately support. I believe that the Australian people will support the Parliament putting in place a voice, and they will support an amendment to the Constitution that obliges the Commonwealth to ensure that Indigenous people are heard. I don't believe the Australian people will support an amendment to the Constitution which is highly complex and explicitly creates a new entity in the Constitution. Uluru calls for the establishment of a First Nations voice and for this to be enshrined in the Constitution. A voice established in legislation as part of a package that includes a constitutional amendment that obliges the Commonwealth to hear Indigenous people is a liberal way of delivering what Uluru calls for. The third part is this is a patriotic agenda. This is about completing the Constitution. That is what Tony Abbott said at Garma in 2013 when he said that the Constitution was incomplete. Our Constitution does not reflect the full inheritance that Australians deserve. This is a further addition to what John Howard said in 2007 when he committed his government to seeking a mandate to change the Constitution to reflect the ancient Indigenous heritage in our Constitution. We have been talking about this issue of constitutional recognition for almost 15 years. So the people who drafted the Uluru Statement did so asking to be included in the Australian Constitution. They didn't ask for a separate state. They didn't ask for division. Some people have said, why do Indigenous people want to be in the old white man's Constitution? The answer is, I assume, because there is support for and belief in modern Australia. This is despite all the failures. Australia remains a great country to which most people want to be connected. The party of patriots, the party most comfortable with patriotism, should therefore drive this agenda, because this is a patriotic agenda. This is not about Black Lives Matter. This is not about defunding the police. This is about Australia coming together under one constitution. Finally, I believe we should build upon our contribution in Canberra, and I move here to the softer part of the reconciliation components. Reconciliation is more than just the constitution and providing agency to people on the ground. It's also about the nation's symbols. Every long-serving Liberal Prime Minister left something significant in Canberra. Menzies drove the development of Canberra. He created Lake Billy Griffin. He was encouraged to name it after himself, but he chose not to. He created the magnificent National Library of Australia, which I think is probably the best building down there. Holt announced the building of the National Gallery. Fraser drove the development of New Parliament House. Howard drove the portrait gallery, the museum, and the very modest reconciliation place. Our government should press ahead and establish a national resting place inside the parliamentary triangle. The national resting place could be more than just a place to repatriate remains with the consent of the traditional owners. It could also be a significant cultural centre inside the parliamentary triangle. I think it's inconceivable, really, and I find it to be so surprising and disappointing that the triangle doesn't have a single significant Indigenous building or precinct inside the parliamentary triangle. In the recent budget, the Morrison government has committed almost $5 million to a business case and a study into this particular project of a national resting place. I believe we should commit to providing the capital to create this institution in this calendar year. The resting place would adorn our capital, much like the Museum of African Americans enriches Washington DC. It is the missing institution. The resting place could be established alongside a declaration of recognition. It could be the repository of the document which binds Australia together. It could be the living example of the Noel Pearson formula, where he talks about Australia being in three parts: ancient Indigenous heritage, British institutions, and a multicultural gift. As Charles Perkins said, the past lives in us. We can't change the past, but we need to make sure that the restlessness in Australia is concluded by delivering a national reconciliation worthy of a great nation. Until we do this, we are denying our children their full and proper inheritance. As Deakin said when he was arguing for our federation, we are trustees for posterity, for the unborn millions, unknown and unnumbered, whose aspirations we may help to fulfil and whose destinies we may assist to determine. And he said that at the Adelaide Federation Convention in 1897. Past, present and future for all of us. Thank you very much.
So many thanks to Senator Bragg. And as I said, there are copies of Arusha, the Liberal Case for National Reconciliation, which are on sale tonight and also on sale online for those who are following us by Zoom. So we come to questions discussion. We've got plenty of time. Just come back here. In your book, you've got some fine photographs in your book. I also should say that Senator Bragg is an honorary fellow of the PM Glynn Institute at the Australian National University. It's there. Australian Catholic University. It's their public policy think tank. I don't know how I made that error. Not having a good night. Anyway, it's been a great speech. So in your book, you've got some interesting photographs, and one of them is the Liberal Party How to Vote form put out in the 1967 referendum by the Liberal Party of New South Wales, and Harold Holt's face is there, and it's saying, yes, yes, which is interesting. Now, as you know, there were two issues went up to the referendum, and one went with 90%, and the other to break the nexus failed. A lot of the debate in 67 really focused on the nexus, because I think an overwhelming majority of Australians was going to vote yes, which is what they did. But because of that, there was no official no case. There was an official no case in the nexus, but no official no case on the matters that affected Aborigines. So if there were a referendum on this occasion, you would expect a no case. Would you think that would make any difference?
Yeah, so firstly, the how to vote card from the referendum, which was dug up by my office, was, I think it's probably one of the best pictures in the book. I made it available to the Holt family, actually, who had never seen it before either. And in fact, at the launch with Gladys Berejiklian, we had members of the Holt family and the Wentworth family present. So I think that was a very nice link back to the past. I'm going to answer your question. It's funny, I had to actually ask the New South Wales Division of the Liberal Party if I could use that image. So I have got all the approvals, don't worry. Look, there will definitely be a strong no case. And because people will say, well, this is a Liberal, this is wrong. Why are we giving these people a special deal? Haven't they already got all our money? And I think there will need to be a very, very well thought through yes case. And I think a lot of it starts with, well, the system we already have is fundamentally illiberal, and it has been for 250 years. And we keep on building on it. We're making it more and more liberal the more and more we make these laws. So we just have to find ways that we can argue a simple yes case, which is just reflecting the truth of the Australian settlement, that there's always been a need for these special laws. The special laws today are more favourable to Indigenous people than they have been for most of the 250 years, because the no case, which will be led by the IPA and others, which I think, by the way, do good work, not on this exact issue, but in other areas, I think will be they'll be tough competitors.
I mean, as you know, the no case will be officially led by politicians. There's got to be politicians to put it up.
I won't tell you who will lead it right now, but I've got some suspicions.
Now, I've got a question from Frank Brennan, who signs off Frank Brackets in lockdown brackets down in Melbourne. And he says this, how about simply amending section 5126, instead of the words, the people of any race for whom it is deemed necessary to make special laws, substitute the words, quote, Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders for whom it is deemed necessary to make special laws after consultation with them.
So, I mean, I quite like that idea from a practical point of view, because I think that if you are going to make special laws, you should have a special system for managing those laws. And I think that's the crux of this argument. And that's something that we've been terrible, terrible at doing. I mean, I think there have been many goes at it over the time. People who follow these debates closely would know that there's been different bodies. I mean, the most recent body we had was ATSIC, which had its own issues. So I think that model could work for from a practical perspective. But the reality is, I mean, even one nation would accept the need for there to always be special laws for Indigenous people, because you've got the principle of native title, you're going to have land rights, you're always going to have these laws. So you're going to have a special system there. If you made it race neutral, it would still solve the practical problem. I don't think it would solve the symbolic issue of the Constitution being vacant on the question of Indigenous people and Indigenous heritage. Now, the Indigenous people are not interested in any other constitutional recognition other than having something which is a practical change. I mean, they're not interested in a flowery preamble. For people that are much smarter than me, you'll know that there are great legal risks that the nation would face if we were to put flowery language anywhere in the Constitution. I'm going to pronounce this guy's name wrong, but is it Scalia? Scalia?
Justice Scalia.
Scalia, the US. He was a High Court Justice, right? Yes,
Supreme Court
Justice. Yeah, who said that, you know, if you want to see Tulare language, go and have a look at the Declaration of Independence, don't look at the Constitution. So I think that actually works quite well for people that take a constitutionally conservative view.
Okay, so there's a question.
The book is terrific, and it's a very clear and well-argued case for yes, and it shows the problems. But I was in the, for my sins, the referendum for the Republic before 2000, and it seems to me that apart from the fact that there were so many different voices, there's a lot of similarities with this debate, and the problem is that no one actually came up with a simple model. That Frank Brennan's the first I've heard, and it won't satisfy the Indigenous groups. Also, they're all very divided. So are Labor and Liberal working together, National Party working together? Because unless you all work together and there is a clear and acceptable model, in that Republican phrase, I don't see it getting up. And the other problem is that the Prime Ministers, whether it was Malcolm Turnbull last time or the current Prime Minister or maybe a future Labor Prime Minister, do not want to put up a referendum like this that will go down.
Yeah, okay. So there's two parts to this answer. The first is, yes, we should study closely what went wrong with the Republic referendum. The second history reference point is the same-sex marriage debate of 2017, where there was a plebiscite, which wasn't compulsory, but had about 80% turnout and a 60% yes vote. So I think that there are some parallels that can be learned there. I think the messaging on that, and especially messaging to Liberal Conservatives, voters on same-sex marriage, was quite different to what you might see to Greens and Labor target voters. And as I say, the Liberals and Nationals campaign focused more on this is a fair thing for families. This is something that will take nothing from you. I mean, you may remember the billboards of the soldiers saying, "I can give my heart for my country, but I can't, you know, get married," or whatever it was. I mean, all those sort of things. So I thought that was quite an effective campaign. So that will provide us with some useful guidance. On the process question, what we're doing now is we're doing co-design. So that is effectively the minister. He's charged Marshall Langton and Tom Calmer to look at the different models that could be used as a legislative voice. And once that is concluded, then the executive government will turn its mind to legal and constitutional arrangements. I think we should make a commitment in this term to hold a referendum in the next term. And then in the next term, we should try and agree what that simple wording would be with Labor. Now, unless we can agree that with Labor, then this thing is never going to happen. There are different views on this, on what sort of wording would be appropriate. I am clearly a minimalist in that I don't want to see the Constitution heavily amended. I don't think it needs to be. I don't think it should be. I don't think it's desirable. I mean, I would style myself as a constitutional conservative, not that I'm too big into labels, but I think it's been an effective charter of government, served the country well. This is the missing piece. We should put that in. But there, you know, the question for people that are heavily engaged in this debate is, will they push for a detailed amendment? And if they do, and they try and force that onto the Labor Party, then this will go nowhere. And the best you'll get is a legislative voice, which would be better than nothing, I should say. But at this stage, we're still trying to get the best possible deal.
Question down there.
Senator, thank you. Particularly pertaining to the voice to Parliament, I've asked this question elsewhere and nobody will touch it.
Yeah.
What is going to be the official criteria for somebody to successfully make a claim to Australian Aboriginality? If this benefit, there's nothing wrong with a benefit for Abbos, is to be in legislation, let alone enshrined in the Constitution, we cannot continue to have Aboriginal self-selection. That will just be guaranteed to a lot of abuse and manipulation. So what is going to be the official criteria for somebody to make a successful claim?
Official criteria, would there be such?
Yeah, so you may be aware of the native title judgment by the High Court, which this is a Mabo, and subsequent cases which have set out a three-part test to determine whether or not a person is Indigenous, and that is the test that we would use, I assume. But I mean, that's not really something that we need to relitigate. I mean, that's been determined by the courts and is now in statute. So I'm not proposing to deal with that now because we don't need to. It's been done.
Question down the back.
Thank you for that. What's it going to cost? A whole new group, bureaucracy, being consulted across Australia. I mean, I thought we had democracy, and that was the point of local representation. I know that you've had several shots. I've talked to Trent Zimmerman at the party functions, and he said, "Yeah, the people don't want this. It will never get up constitutionally. So we're just going to introduce legislative changes." So,
yeah.
And I
okay,
know
all right.
You so started.
Okay, let's stop there because. One at a time, okay? Yeah.
Well, just before you answer, I hear what you've said. I assume you're in good faith, but I do note that you started by questioning everybody's legitimacy, and I do take that personally. So
I'm not sure what you mean.
Okay,
by that.
I didn't feel my legitimacy was questioned, but then you
yeah.
never know. Okay,
all right, well look,
to...
thanks for that question. So the first part is, at the moment, we're not getting a very good deal. I mean, the nation is spending $33 billion on Indigenous programs, and the Productivity Commission itself... Sorry?
Federally.
Yeah, and the Productivity Commission itself has said that it's not working very well. I mean, I've travelled all around this state, right? I've been to Bourke, Brewarrina, Nowra, Kempsey. You know, I try and travel across the state to try and meet with communities to get a good sense of what is going on. I think that's an important thing you would expect me to do, right? And I think a lot of the feedback I get is, look, there was a program that ran for 2 years, it was about to go, you know, really well, and it's been canned. So at the moment, it is all over the shop, right? The $33 billion, this is according to the PC, is not evaluated properly, and it is not money that the nation is getting good value for. So I think that if you had the proper front end on that car, that you were getting the advice going to government, going to the departments, then you could improve the investment that is being made. I mean, you may even find that you get efficiencies. And so we have appointed an Indigenous person who is, Mr. Mokak, who is an Indigenous person who is a productivity commissioner. So he's leading this body of work around having a proper evaluation strategy because, I mean, I think it's entirely reasonable point for you to raise that why would the nation spend $33 billion on a particular group of people without ensuring that that was being spent well? Because that is coming from the Commonwealth. And so I think that's an important thing that the voice could actually really, really improve because it would be connected to community, right? Rather than being determined in Macquarie Street or Canberra, you're going to get proper feedback and advice from the ground about programs.
Now hang on, we've got to move on. Okay, who's next?
There's a question here.
And okay.
You mentioned that what you could call reconciliation had two components. What you call a hard part and a soft part. Was the hard part what you would call contentious legislation, or was it hard in some other way? And what exactly is encompassed in the soft part?
Okay, so the hard part is having a debate about the Constitution and about laws and about national policy. That is hard, and it should be hard. This is a democracy. This is a robust democracy. So that's the hard part. So constitutional amendments, policy, that's hard. The softer stuff is just the stuff that we should do. I mean, I think it's incredible that there are now... I mean, if you look at Canberra, right, it's a purpose-built national capital. You know, there's no Aboriginal flag inside any part of the public area of the parliament. There are now, as a result of the unveiling of the statue of John Gorton and his dog, more statues of dogs than there are of Indigenous people or women in Canberra. And there is, as I said in my remarks, there are no institutions, right? And this is a purpose-built national capital. I mean, this is not England. This is Australia. So I think we could do a much better job of paying respect to that culture and that history. I mean, I noticed it in, I mean, in, I'm 36, right? So when I went to school, there was bibs and bobs. Year 11 history, we learned all about John Batman. Of course, John Batman, who was involved in massacres in Tasmania. I notice it in my own children. I mean, they're much more aware of the full balance of Australian history. I don't think this is something that we should be afraid of. I think this is a good thing, as Noel Pearson has talked about, that Australia is a modern conglomeration of Indigenous heritage, British institutions, which have served the country so well, and now a multicultural gift. So I'm all for embracing all parts of that. I don't think it's a trade-off. I think often these things are seen as trade-offs. I know that people feel symbolism is important, and I know that people are emotional about it sometimes, but I think we can do a better job.
You spoke about, in your book, you write about John Howard's address at the Sydney Institute in October 2007. Now, to what extent are you moving beyond what John Howard said at the time? I think at the time it surprised some people. It was supported, I think, by Noel Pearson and some others. How much are you going beyond what John Howard suggested in 2007?
Well, again, it shows what a great policy clearinghouse you run here at the Sydney Institute. I mean, that was a critical speech. It was a speech which obviously wasn't able to be delivered on because the government changed. I mean, Howard at the time, it's a very good lengthy speech, was talking about probably a preamble, a set of words somewhere in the document, in the Constitution, which would have reflected the fact that there is a continuing history of 60,000 years of Indigenous heritage. In that 14 years since, there have been half a dozen, maybe a dozen, inquiries, reviews, committees, commissions, looking at how that could be done. And 10 years later, at the Uluru Convention, the Indigenous people said, we're not interested in flowery recognition. We actually need some agency to solve some of our problems, because the problems are intractable. And the Closing the Gap targets are focused on education, economic participation. Because in order to be successful in this country, in the modern world, you need to have some sort of economic agency, which comes from education, which comes from economic participation. So what the Indigenous leadership have put forward is a request to be consulted on laws and policies which are made for them. This is non-binding advice. I mean, I think this is pretty soft. I mean, I find this striking how controversial this can be. I mean, this is the country we have. We have today 18 different laws on our books which are made for Indigenous people. I mean, I think that if I made a special law for John Mangos, I'd like to think that he would be able to have a special say on that. I mean, I think it's that simple, and I'm not trying to trivialise this, but it's critical that if we want to have special laws, different systems, that we need to be prepared to give people a say on how those laws are deployed.
Down the back.
I take all your points, but there's one problem in all of this, and this affects people who have little to do with Indigenous affairs and are God-fearing, good-living Australians, and that is that the decades of mismanagement of ordinary Indigenous lives in this country has been not only a white man's burden, it is an Indigenous person's burden. And Josephine Cashman at the moment is trying to produce an Indigenous movement from the grassroots up, because her thesis is that the leaders of the Aboriginal and Indigenous communities have for too long been a small clique that have played the rules and have left the rest of the community marginalised. Now, when ordinary Australians who are non-Indigenous watch what's happened over 40, 50, yeah, 60, 100, 200 years, can you blame them for having a problem with saying only when Indigenous leaders are consulted things will get better? Because they say it's been the Indigenous leaders that have let the Indigenous community down.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of points I make there, Anne. And the first is, I think there is a problem of proximity that many Australians don't know any Indigenous people. I think that means that that is a that makes this debate much harder than it did on same-sex marriage. The second part is I've tried to do my own investigation by travelling widely. And as I say, when you travel to communities like Bourke and Brewarrina, which are part of my state, I mean, people are not talking about the Constitution there. They're talking about, I mean, and that would be the same in any low socioeconomic community, whether it was Indigenous or non-Indigenous. I mean, people don't think about the Constitution. I mean, why would you? I mean, I have to.
Land claims. Compensation.
Hang on, excuse me.
So the point is, though, that the people do want to have more agency. That is feedback I get on the ground from community leaders, from community members. And I think that, so it's critical that for us to do this, it's got to be connected to country. It's got to be connected to communities for it to be effective. And that is going to be, like, even in this state, right? I mean, this is the biggest population of Indigenous people in this state, about 300,000. And I know from personal experience that the issues in Redfern are different to the issues in Bree, Warrina, they're different to the issues in Kempsey and Nowra, right? So the local voices structures that WIAD is currently consulting on need to be different in different areas. They need to reflect different community traits and desires. The question of what a national voice would do, I think, is quite separate. I mean, for example, you would know that, many people would know that we, the national government, are in a terrible mess when it comes to the Aboriginal flag. I mean, effectively, the Keating government gazetted the Aboriginal flag under the Flags Act in 1995 without, I mean, this is a good example, without bothering to consult anyone, they just gazetted it. And the guy who actually owned it and created it, Harold Thomas, said, hang on, that's actually my flag. Thomas then goes to the federal court in 1997, secures the copyright from the federal court. He still owns the flag. And then fast forward to 2020, and the AFL, on the back of feedback from local Indigenous charities and community groups, have said, we're not going to pay to use the Aboriginal flag anymore because Aboriginal medical services and charities are being slugged bills to use a flag that is supposed to be widely held. And so we are in the process of trying to purchase the rights to the flag. But it's a very good example of, oh yeah, we'll just do what we think would be fine. And so if we are successful in purchasing the rights to that flag and buying out the copyright, that flag needs to be vested somewhere. I think that could be owned by the National Voice.
Well, getting towards the end now, just maybe just reflect a bit on, because your book's about liberals, a liberal approach, a liberal attitude. So just reflect a bit on some of the important ministers in this area, our backbenchers that you would have studied, although you're a young man, but you would have studied them. Mm. Paul Hasluck, Bill Wentworth, Neville Bonner, who I think you mentioned his 50th anniversary of going into the Senate's coming up soon. Just reflect on how they fit into this. So one's Indigenous, two are not. What drove them and what was that all about?
Well, I think Bill Wentworth is a person who really kicks the ball off. And throughout his parliamentary career, he had a long parliamentary career. He was the member for McKellar. You know, he was the first person to talk about having a system or having a centre which preserved Aboriginal languages and culture. He was concerned that Aboriginal people were going to die out in large part, and so he wanted to record the languages and the culture that he saw across the country. He travelled very widely, and during the parliamentary recesses, he would go all across Australia, and there are photos in the book where he would go out with some of the trackers in the Northern Territory, and he would go into really remote communities. I interviewed Philip Ruddock for this book, and Ruddock said, you know, that he was almost fanatical about it in making sure that there was a system in place which preserved that language. Now that centre, which is AATSIS, has done that today. I mean, this book wouldn't exist without AATSIS. He was also very big on trying to push for land rights, and so he was involved with some of the walk-offs up in the Northern Territory. And ultimately, he came back as Aboriginal Affairs Minister during the Gorton government. So he was the first Minister for Aboriginal Affairs. But it was a Fraser government that legislated land rights. So Wentworth was, you know, talking about this all through his life. And I think he is the key he's a key figure. I mean, I think it's important to note that, you know, if you think this, if you think this is about identity politics or someone being woke or something, I mean, Wentworth was talking about this concept of consulting Aboriginal people 60 years ago. So I think it's quite a quite an important concept. The other person that I should just single out here, I guess, is Malcolm Fraser, because Fraser was, he spent a lot of time in the Northern Territory. He was, as I say, you know, from Charles Perkins and co, very widely respected. However, I should say that there was some frustration, and I say this as a keen fisherman, about his trips to the Northern Territory to fish with Yunupingu and co, that he was more focused on the barramundi than he was on the policy issues at play, which, you know, I think is understandable at a certain point. But it does show that there is a definite frustration within the Indigenous community that people would come into these communities and be more focused on the optics, perhaps, than really trying to solve some of the intractable issues.
That's fine. Many thanks for that. And it's a good way to end up, because what is in this book is, as it ought to be, is a very strong focus on history and players, men and women in the issue going back two centuries. And so thanks for an important speech tonight. It's one in a series we've had. We've had John Howard here, we've had Noel Pearson here, we've had Megan Davis here and others over the years. But you are the latest and a very important contribution. Good speech tonight, and best of luck with the book. As I said, we've got the Burundi, Baraja, the Liberal case for national reconciliation, and Senator Bragg, well done, and thank you.
Thanks, Jared. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.